Hi. All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to meditate for 2 minutes. And when we come out of meditation, we're going to say this neat prayer. And then we're going to read some things, and then we're going to do some things, and then we're going to talk for 5 more hours. Good?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So, 2-minute meditation starts now.
Prayer.
God,
please lay aside everything that you have known about addiction, alcoholism, the big book, the 12 steps, this workshop, myself, and especially you, God, so I may have an open mind and a new experience of all these things. Help me see the truth. Amen.
This reading is called Beginning. This is the moment of embarking. All auspicious signs are in place. In the beginning, all things are hopeful. We prepare ourselves to start anew. Though we may be intent on the magnificent journey ahead, all things are contained within the first moment. Our optimism, our faith, our resolution, our innocence. In order to start, we must make a decision. This decision is a commitment to daily self-cultivation. We must make a strong connection with our inner selves. Outside matters are superfluous. Alone and naked, we negotiate all of life's travails. Therefore, we alone must make something of ourselves, transforming ourselves into the instrument for experiencing the deepest spiritual essence of life. Once we make our decision, all things will come to us. Auspicious signs are not a superstition, but a confirmation. They are a response. It is said that if one chooses to pray to a rock with enough devotion, even the rock will come alive. In the same way, once we choose to commit ourselves to a spiritual practice, even the mountains and the valleys will reverberate to the sound of our purpose.
All right. If you're wondering why this weekend we call the wall, it's the What Any Length Looks Like Big Book Workshop. And it's an acronym and I'm a Pink Floyd fan, so it worked out well for me. And so the course of the weekend is our description of what it looks like to go to any length. And these are questions you have to ask yourself. And, I'm being led to do something I hadn't even planned on doing, but I want everybody to turn to page 58 in the book. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. This is the step before the steps. This is a departure point. If you have decided you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. So before you make a decision to attempt to go through this process and to walk this path, and to live this way of life, you need to ask yourself, have I made this decision? Am I willing to go to any length? So this is the step before the steps. At some point over the course of the weekend, we'll talk about step zero. Step zero has to do with this. Step zero is that wonderfully horrific time between your last drink or your last drug and when you are given to this process and this way of life. And dying the addict death or dying the alcoholic death or living life on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face. Because for a lot of us, the spiritual life looks like the bitter end. Because our mind immediately defaults to the version of religion that we grew up with. And we think that living life on a spiritual basis has something to do with that. It can. And it doesn't have to. But you got to make this decision. For me, I made a decision that I wanted what this man had, and I copied him. We don't have to reinvent the wheel here. If you find somebody that's got what you want, you stick to them, you watch them, and you do what they do. And then you get the version of happy, joyous, and free a lot of the times. But you're going to flip back and forth because life as a human being is a constant state of fluctuation. You don't stay in any state of being consistently because we are influenced by our environment and we are also influenced by what's going on internally, and those two things meet. So therefore, we're in a constant state of fluctuation. The goal is to be consistent, and that's why spiritual practices are important. So what I want to talk about for the next few minutes is this idea of using the circle and triangle as a guide. It used to be on the title page of our big book. Do y'all have it anywhere on the wall in here, circle, triangle? Oh, is it up there? Oh, there it is. That there is an ancient spiritual symbol. It represents the idea that mind, body, and spirit can be together as one. We can experience this state of wholeness, this state of being. We always think of integrity, right? When metal has integrity, it doesn't have any blemishes. It's whole. But because of our culture and our society, we've confused integrity, morality, and ethics. We get them all confused. But when we're talking about being in integrity, being means a state of being whole. And in Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous, that circle and triangle is our way to be in integrity. But don't think of integrity in the way of morals and ethics. It's being whole, right? And our forebears, is that what that word? I think that's what it references. Our forebears here used to have it in our big book. In our big book, up until about 1994, when you opened the title page of Alcoholics Anonymous, where it says a story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism, there used to be a circle and triangle. And it had our three legacies: recovery, unity, and service. And because of there were some people that were making money using the symbol, and AA had a problem, you know, with outside enterprises, and you know, there was some litigation going on and the possibility of AA having to release last names because we're in the court. They decided to not fight for it, and so therefore they removed it. And so technically, the circle and the triangle is not, you know, an AA logo anymore, because they didn't want to fight for it. So they said people could have at it, put it on T-shirts, on, you know, poker chips and medallions, whatever it is. So it's not there anymore. But when I'm sponsoring somebody, the first meeting I have, one of the first meetings I have with them, we're going to sit down and we're going to draw the circle and the triangle back in the big book. And we're going to have a conversation about AA's three legacies. You know, and what do those mean? You know, where do you find the foundation of the triangle in recovery? All right, it's not in the fellowship. That foundation of that triangle recovery is found in the practical application of these 12 steps as outlined in the big book. That is the foundation. I carried my mind into the recovery process found in the big book, and as a result, I had a vast change in feeling and outlook. My reaction to life began to change. I did have upheaval internally. And I had a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from addiction as a result of finding recovery in the program, which are the 12 steps, which are suggested as your program of recovery. They were suggested. They were directed to me. All right. I don't recall Dante suggesting a lot of things, but he said, if you know, do this, do that. And it worked better for me at that time in my life. My body goes into the fellowship. So when you work the 12 steps, you're restored to sanity, which means you have much more proportion in areas of your life, and you're able to think much more clearly than you were prior to going through that process. The body craves unity. We crave connection. Believe it or not, drugs and alcohol took us to a higher state of consciousness. Why? Because we connected. In those first years of drugs and alcohol working, we experienced connection with others, probably to the greatest degree we'd ever will experience it. I discovered the magic of alcohol and whiskey and cocaine in the midst of excitement. And my life took on new meaning, and it was fascinating what I'd been missing out on for so many years when I first discovered it, when alcohol and drugs were working. Fear of economic insecurity left me when drugs and alcohol were working. All right? The idea that I could benefit other people existed when alcohol and drugs were working. No matter how far down the scale I had gone, I could see that my experience could benefit others when alcohol and drugs were working. When alcohol and drugs were working, I didn't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. It did not exist in that moment when alcohol and drugs were working. That is significant that the 9-step promises came true when alcohol and drugs were working. And then they don't work. And my mind convinces me that maybe perhaps one day they will work again. That I can go to that magic spot and stop. If I could stop somewhere between the second and the fifth one, I'd still be smoking crack. Because that was magic. You know. But then 3-4 days later, not so much. So, I need to create connection. If addiction is an illness of separation and isolation, the answer to that problem is connection. And so we crave unity. We crave the idea of belonging. And that's why our stories are so powerful. That's why our stories bring us together, because we come together on spiritual imperfection. We bond on our brokenness. That's what brings us together. We identify on our brokenness. And once that identification is made, we can build on top of that. And so the fellowship I crave doesn't just show up. You know, it's funny. I was in a meeting last week and I heard something for the first time. So the big book was published in April of 1939. There was no such thing as an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in April 1939. There was no such thing as the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous in April of 1939. In A Vision for You, on page 165, let's go there real quick. Oh, no, I'm sorry. The beginning of the chapter, on 152. We have shown how we got out from under. You say, yes, I'm willing, but am I to be consigned to a life where I shall be stupid, boring, and glum like some righteous people I see? I know I must get along without drugs and alcohol, but how can I? Have you a sufficient substitute, you might ask? We say, yes, there is a substitute, and it's a vastly more than that. It is a fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you. It's quite fascinating to me. Once I was listening to a guy the other night talk about this, and like, to be a fellow, you have to do certain things to be a fellow when you're talking about education and the academics. I heard an old timer years ago say, I did not become a member until I had worked all 12 steps. But we have a third tradition that says the only requirement for membership is a desire not to drink or use. So this is different. When I heard that old timer, something in me resonated, like connected with that. Because the fellowship and the unity I have experienced since I got here has nothing to do with meeting attendance. It has everything to do with working the steps. I felt like I belonged after I'd worked the steps by the middle of 2008. I started going to meetings in 2004. Not once between 2004 and 2007 did I feel like I belonged. When you say welcome home, I never felt like I was welcomed home. I felt like I was an outsider looking in. I didn't belong here. I looked at the differences. I didn't look for similarities. So how do I build this thing called unity? Because that's where your body goes, to find the fellowship it craves. Well, we have to get a home group. That's what I was given. The assignment of home group. The assignment of attending group conscience. And then the service positions were already taken. And I'll never forget this. Dante had me meet him at the Friday night home group at like 5. It was like around 5:30 or 5:45. This meeting starts at 8 o'clock. Why am I getting there so early? So I get there, and he and I chop it up outside. And we go in, and he opens this big old closet, and there are these racks of chairs. They're in stacks, and they have wheels on them. And this is an auditorium. So you got to take out, there's stacks of 10, and I got to put out 150 chairs. And he's got a big book study he's doing up on the second floor. So he goes upstairs to do the big book study, and I'm in there setting up these chairs. All right. He comes back downstairs. Treatment center vans are starting to roll in. People are starting to roll in. You know, a few people come in, help me set up the chairs. But I felt like I had a responsibility to set those chairs up, right? So I go outside and I watch what he's doing. He's talking. Everybody knows him. He's talking to everybody. He's talking to newcomers. You know, he's talking to people getting off the treatment center vans. And then we have the meeting. And then he helps break down the meeting. And I help him do that. And then we stand outside and we talk, and we're the last people to leave. It's like him or this guy Adams, they lock the church up, and we go to the Longhorn Steakhouse. So what he taught me without telling me was the meeting before the meeting, and the meeting after the meeting. And for the first 3 years of my recovery, that was my schedule. Now, what ended up happening is as I started sponsoring people, they would meet me at the church to do step work from 5:30 until 7. And then we'd go set up the meeting, and then we'd go outside and hang out, and then we all went to Longhorn. And what happened is I felt like I was welcomed home. I experienced unity at a level and a depth that I'd never experienced before. I felt like that was my home group. From that group, I developed relationships with men that I am still in touch with to this day. You know, I met my goddaughter's father at that meeting. I learned how to disclose intimate details of my life to other men because I knew they were not going to judge me. As a result, I found the side leg of that triangle. I took my mind through the recovery process found in the first 164 pages of our big book. I had a transformation. I discovered unity, and the transformation continued. And then I was told, if through work and sacrifice you attempt to perfect and enlarge your spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice, that translates into inconvenient. Right? Doing things that are important for this way of life when a part of me does not want to do it, but I do it anyway. And I started to feed my spirit. And I don't know what spirituality means, but sometimes I love this definition. Enlightened self-interest. The best way for Tarek to get his is to make sure everybody gets theirs first. Now, I don't know if that's a true statement. It could be true. It could be a lie. But I will tell you that I am convinced and I am certain that it makes me a better human being. And that's important here. Because I think a lot of this process, if not all of it, is about completing or attempting to complete our humanity. Because one of the things addiction and alcoholism take away from us is our humanity. They took my humanity. Sitting in trap houses and crack houses for days on end is not humane in my book. You know, going 4 or 5 days with no food is not humane in my book. Creating a list of things I swore I'd never do to get high and then doing all those things is not humane in my book. So what it did, like for years when I was in those 2004 to 2007, one of the reasons I think I would convince myself delusionally that I was going to relapse is because I was bored. That my life had no direction and no sense of purpose. Well, if you work to perfect and enlarge your spiritual life through sacrifice, not only will you survive the certain trials and low spots ahead, which are guaranteed and promised, that you're going to have valleys and you're going to have darkness in your life as part of the human journey, that you will have a sense of purpose. Because earlier in the first session, I shared with you the idea of turning your struggle with addiction and alcoholism, converting it from a liability to an asset. One of the ways that conversion takes place is you're going to be sitting, hopefully, I pray to God that all of you experience this. I don't know if you will. You know, historically, from what I've experienced in 14 years, I don't think a lot of you are. Prove me wrong, please. You're going to be sitting across the table from another addict or alcoholic, and then you're going to win their confidence. And then something can be done because you're properly armed with facts about yourself as a result of working steps. And they're going to buy everything you're selling them, right? Because this is a sales process. Our founders were like the reason this program spread the way it is because a lot of guys in the beginning were traveling salespeople. We're up here giving a pitch this weekend. We're pitching you on this program of recovery. Right? The big book, one of the guys in the book says, once I was sold on the ideas contained in this book. That's what we're doing up here. And what happens is you're sitting across the table with that individual and you sell them on the ideas contained in this book, and then they follow through with the course of action and they transform, and you're caught up in that experience. You're along for the ride. And that ride is going to benefit you more than your own personal ride going through the steps. And now you have that spirit legacy that we're talking about. You feed your spirit through work and self-sacrifice, and now your life has a sense of meaning. And all the stuff you went through, all the stuff I went through as it relates to my relationship with drugs and alcohol, now makes sense. It has new meaning because I use it to help save someone else's life. That's why it doesn't. Now it's not just a mark, a stain on my record. It was necessary to give me the capacity and the ability to be involved in a healing process, transformational process. That's what this circle and triangle is about. The foundation has to be the steps. You got to get involved with the fellowship. You have to, or you're not going to stay. If you don't feel like you belong when you come in here, you're not going to stay. And then you got to sacrifice, sacrifice, sacrifice. We say that you can't keep what you have until you give it away. I'm going to let you in on a secret. You will never get it unless you give it away. You will never get it unless you give it away. Now, that's counterintuitive, man. You can't go out in the real world and say, I'm only going to keep what I have by giving everything away. It doesn't work. You know, you can't go back to the county jail and say, you know, to win, I got to surrender and give up. You know, that's not the place you want to give up. So a lot of these little paradoxes we have in here don't really work in the outside world, but they work in here, in our little society. And everything, if you get off the path and you want to find out what's going on, I encourage you, just sit down and look at your circle and triangle. What am I doing with recovery? Do I have unfinished amends? Am I spending time devoting to this relationship in prayer and meditation? What is going on at my home group? Do I have... And here's the thing, like, unity, get this if you don't get anything else when it comes to unity, has nothing to do with meeting attendance. This here is a guy I am closer with than the majority of people in my life, and I see him two or three times a year. We talk on the phone almost every day. If he were to ask, he has access to every area of my life. He knows everything going on with me. We have unity. He and I don't attend meetings together. It's not like I see him in a meeting and that's why he and I have unity. We have unity because we talk about, we compare notes about walking a spiritual path, because his spiritual path and his ideas and beliefs are very, very different from mine. But we never try to make the other one right or wrong. We don't ever try to disprove the other one. This is part of unity, right? This is part of unity, and that's what you got to have. And you got to have a handful of those relationships. On top of, yes, you want to go to meetings because the newcomer, you got to show them. You got to show them how to do it. So that's the circle and triangle in a nutshell. I could go on and on about that, but I'm going to turn it over to Brandon so he can talk about powerlessness.
I think the rails are coming off a little bit here. Or we're coming off the rails a little bit because one of the things that, especially if you know me and if you interact with me or really either one of us, or you see our notes, or you see what we've got going on up here. We have a plan. We think we know what we're going to talk about. And then something happens. And then a thought comes in. And then Spirit speaks. And then, maybe I'm going to talk about something different. So I'm going to kind of jump all over the place. But one of the places that I want to you touched on something, and it made me think. So we see the short form of the 12 traditions up here. The third tradition, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. The only requirement for CA membership is a desire to stop using cocaine and all mind-altering drugs, right? Like, that's pretty simple, right? Pretty simple and to the point. That's the short form. of the third tradition. Okay, there's a short form of the third tradition, and there's a long form of the third tradition. And there's even a longer form of the third tradition that explains what it is in the 12 and 12 that talks about that. But if we look at page 562 in our book, they've got the 12 tradition short form. Again, tradition 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Now, I find that fascinating because in the foreword to the first edition, it says something about an honest desire to stop drinking. By the time we got to the tradition short form, we don't even need to be honest about it. We just want to stop, right? But then we got the long form over here on the opposite page on 563, and it says, our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism. Got news for you. That's a lot different. Because in college, my brother had a golden retriever. His name was Hoops. And we were at a party one time, and he had a bunch of beer. They thought it was cool to pour beer into a bowl. And Hoops, he fell down the stairs and finished on the landing, and he slept there all night long. Okay? If you poured beer in Hoops's bowl ever after that point, he never drank it. He went and sniffed it, and he knew what it was, and he didn't drink it again. So he had a desire to stop drinking. By the short form, Hoops qualifies. Okay? By the long form, it says it ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism. That means when I start, I can't stop. And when I'm stopped, I can't stay stopped. I'll talk more about that here in a minute. So that's a different requirement, right? Then it also says, hence we may refuse none who wish to recover. Okay? So you show up to a meeting, you are not a member. If you show up to a meeting and you don't want to get well, you are definitely not a member. You are only a member when you are alcoholic or addict and you want to do something about it. That's when you become a member. There's a bunch of people in this room that maybe will join us someday. Maybe they won't. Who knows? And then it goes on to talk about some other things, which is, nor ought AA membership ever depend on money or conformity. Any two or three alcoholics gathered together for sobriety may call themselves an AA group, provided that as a group they have no other affiliation. So there is no such thing as a doctor's meeting of AA, because that would be a different affiliation. We can't have Georgia fans and Auburn fans and Florida fans having a meeting because that's a different affiliation. Get this. Technically, per the third tradition, we cannot have men's and women's meetings because that's another affiliation. Now, those are good for different purposes, and if you would like to understand why, come talk to me sometime. But a women's meeting cannot deny a man access. A man's meeting cannot deny a woman access. They are men's and women's meetings, but it is open to anyone because that's what the third tradition says. Now, so get this. So we got a long form and a short form of the traditions, which kind of makes me wonder, is there a long form and a short form of the steps? I mean, we got these up here, right? They're a line or two. They're pretty simple to the point. Get this. There is a long form. And it's in the book. It starts in the doctor's opinion, and it goes all the way to page 164. Of that, the first step starts in the doctor's opinion. There's 7 pages in the doctor's opinion, and it goes all the way to page 43. So that means there's 50 pages devoted to the first step in the Big Book. So why is it that we hear people say, I showed up to a meeting, I did my first step? Well, why do we need 50 pages? Maybe it's the foundation of everything we're going to do after that, if you could find that reading. The second step is found in the chapter We Agnostics. Steps 3 and 4 are in the chapter How It Works. Into Action, get this shit. Into Action covers steps 5 through 11. So we had 50 pages devoted to the first step, and then we have, 14 pages here? 16 pages devoted to steps 5 through 11, right? Here's some craziness. When we start on page 89, we've got a chapter called Working with Others. Everybody understands that that's about the 12th step, right? But then we have four more chapters after that. Those four chapters are titled Two Wives, The Family Afterwards, Two Employers, and A Vision for You. Okay? Talks about in the book that we practice these principles in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. Get this. Homes, two wives, the family afterward. Occupations, two employers, and affairs, a vision for you. You know, there's three parts to the 12th step. The first part is having had a spiritual awakening as the result of working these steps, which means 1 through 11. We tried to carry this message to other alcoholics. It's part two. Sponsorship. And the third part, and the part that occupies four chapters in this book, more chapters than any other part, is and practice these principles in all our affairs. You see, the whole point of the steps, as I see it, this is Brandon's opinion, is the whole point of the steps is to get to where we can practice these principles in all our affairs. It's the whole point. So if you never get to that last part, the third part of the 12th step, pretty good chance you're not going to stay sober. You're not going to stay clean. Because it's only the most important part. The 12th step occupies, I think it's 76 pages in this book. Okay? Out of the 171 pages devoted to recovery, 76 of them, two-fifths nearly, are devoted to the 12th step. So what that tells me is the first step's probably pretty important, and the 12th step's really important. And who in here has been to treatment before? Who in here has been to treatment multiple times? Okay. You can go through and you can try to figure out all the triggers list and relapse prevention program and all that stuff. But here's what I can guarantee you, is that if you do not practice these principles in all your affairs, you will not stay clean and sober. And it talks about it multiple times in this book. There's a wonderful paragraph on page 70 that I probably don't have to read because I've got it committed to memory, but I'm going to read it anyways because I just want to make sure that it's got that extra emphasis. But suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does this mean that we are going to get drunk? Some people tell us so. But it is only a half-truth. It depends on us and our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have an honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will have been forgiven and we will have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience. That sounds a lot like practicing the principles in all my affairs. How do I know how to do that? Well, if I've got a competent sponsor and he's walked me through steps 1 through 7 to this point, and then I've gone out and I made amends and I see how I affect other people in my life, and I start to really practice this thing of being present in the 10th step and trying to connect and clean up my connection with this power, whatever it is that's keeping me sober in the 11th step, and then trying to carry this message to other people, then I can actually accomplish this. But if I don't work all those steps, I'll never be able to accomplish this. So what is it that we're trying to do? I hear all sorts of people talking about why a person's alcoholic, right? I was molested. I was beat up. I was homeless. I got a divorce. They didn't respect me. I wasn't good enough. I had low self-esteem. Blah, 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 blah. Two reasons that we are alcoholic or addict. Is that when I start at certain times, I don't know when I'm stopping. Not all the time, at certain times. And then the second part is when I'm stopped, I don't know how long that's going to last. Okay? The first part is the physical allergy. The first part is what I suffer from when I put something into my body and it starts the fire. It gets it going. Now, for me personally, something happens between the second and the fourth drink. Okay? Thursday night, woman I was married to, our kids, and a bunch of other people from the neighborhood, we would go to Los Bravos, the Mexican restaurant around the corner that had really crappy food. But you know what they had good? They had good beer and good margaritas, right? So, if I would go to Los Bravos and I would order one 32-ounce mug of beer, I could drink that beer and return to the house and not drink anymore. Now get this though. If I would go to Los Bravos and I would have that 32-ounce beer and I would get a second 32-ounce beer, so now I got 64 ounces. We were definitely stopping at the liquor store on the way home, and I was probably going to be found somewhere in the basement around 2 to 4 in the morning with all the lights on and the TV going on and passed out. Probably what was going to happen. Something magical happened between 32 ounces and 64 ounces that lit that fire for me. I could have one. I could have two. I could not have over 24 ounces because something happened. Now, I've analyzed this, and it's very clear to me that that was somewhere in that range. If I had one 40-ounce margarita, whoop, we were gone, right? Who wants to go out? Like, we'll take the family home. We'll drop them off. We're going to head back over and go play Golden Tee somewhere, right? Stay up all night. Maybe have a fire pit. We'll solve all the world's problems until we run out of alcohol or somebody passes out or everybody passes out. That was what happened. So if I have an allergy, say to peanuts, right? And I eat peanuts and I get a rash on my arm, I'm gonna look pretty silly if I just sit there and yell at the rash and say, "Go away, go away, go away," right? So the only answer really is just don't eat peanuts. Right? Can you pull that video up? I'm gonna pull this video up because I just think it's funny as hell. And this to me is like, this is absolutely what we experience. Oh, hold on. You're on.
I'm gonna open up two beers. Okay. You tell me what sounds more refreshing. Gotcha.
Right? It's so abundantly obvious that when you put it in, what's going to happen? We probably don't know. I mean, maybe jail, maybe a four-day run, maybe stay up, maybe hawk your TV, somebody else's TV. I mean, who knows? So when you hear it at meetings, just don't drink no matter what. Duh! Right? It's so obvious. Just don't do that. Well, here's the problem. As I got a mind that tells me this time it's going to be different. This time I'll be able to just have the one 32-ounce beer. Right? So it must be not that I put it in. It must be that I need to just decide not to, right? But here's the thing is I got this twisted, like, mental obsession. Like, there's the obsession that everybody knows this obsession. It's like the one where somebody puts a bag over your head and you'll do anything to get the bag off your head because you're suffocating, right? Like that obsession, like, when that specific obsession shows up to you, there's not a whole lot to do, right? You're probably going to go, okay, unless you're unable to get access to it, which we're pretty resourceful people. We'll find a way. Now, the book talks about this other thing, which is called the suddenly, right? The suddenly is there's a guy named Jim in there, and he's got the he's working for the automobile dealership that he used to own, right? And he decides that he's going to go out into the country and stop at a bar that where they have sandwiches and have some sandwiches, right? And then suddenly the insane thought of whiskey and milk sounds pretty good. So I'll pour this whiskey and this milk and it won't hurt me. Here's why, because I got a sandwich in my stomach. I'm full. And then the experiment goes so well, he does it again and then again, right? And then you got this other guy in the book, this guy named Fred, who, this Fred guy, he's got it all going on. He's got the charming wife. He's got the kids of college age. He just went to Washington to present some accounting evidence. Like, this dude, it's the end of a perfect day. And then suddenly, he crosses into the bar and the thought hits him, it would be nice to have a drink. Suddenly, right? And then there's the third kind that I'm sure you're all familiar with, which is you're sitting there at work, and then the obsession kind of comes and says, hey, Tarek, let's go get some stuff. And you're like, man, it's 10 o'clock. I'm working hard. I'm finally saving some money. I'm not doing it. Not. Then 30 minutes later, the obsession comes back and says, hey, Tarek, let's go get some stuff. Come on. No. I need to work. And then 30 minutes later, hey, Tarek, come on. It's like, do not disturb. I got to make a call. I'm gone. And then what? I mean, when do you show back up? Maybe in a day, maybe 2 days.
When I show back up.
Right. Tarek, you know that we've put you on probation because you've missed so many days already. You know that you're going to get fired if you do this again. But what happens?
I do it again.
He does it again, right? So, duh. I mean, which one was that? So, in light of this mental obsession, I've got to have something that comes in and separates that. Now, I'll tell a story, and then Tarek's going to talk a little bit more about the spiritual part of it. So, I'm about... I'd say I'm about 3 years sober, and I'm at my parents' place. It's the same lake house that my dog and I slept on the back patio, where I forgot to come up with the story of what I was doing there. And it's the end of a perfect day. It is absolutely like it. It's one of those days where the evening it cooled off just right. Maybe the breeze is coming in. I'm the grill master. Like I'm literally the person in charge of the grill, and I'm down at the grill and I'm cooking. Everybody else is up in the house, and I hear them in the house and they're laughing and they're carrying on, and it's perfect, right? The sun's coming off just right off the lake. Everything's so nice. And the thought comes. Now there's a difference between a thought and obsession. But the thought comes. A thought is a thought, right? If I ask you to hold your breath, you're going to hold your breath for a period and the thought's going to come, I need to breathe. So you do, right? That's a thought. Now, an obsession is I put that bag over your head, you're going to fight to breathe again, right? Everybody understand the difference between a thought and obsession? Because there's a lot of people that get twisted and they think that just because I thought about drinking or I thought about using that I'm fucked. It's not true. It's a thought. Right. So the thought came this day while I'm grilling, and the thought came that it would be nice to have a beer. Okay. Now, my internal response to the thought of it would be nice to have a beer is always a chuckle, because I know I am not capable of having a beer. If I have one, I don't know how many are in the fridge, but they're going to be consumed. Right. And so I sit there and I kind of do that little chuckle, laugh it off, right? The thought came, I laughed it off. Thought stays. I'm sitting there and I'm like, no. Like, come on, seriously. It's fine. But then the liar that Tara probably will talk about starts in my head, and it's like, you know, everybody's upstairs. Nobody will really know. In fact, they probably wouldn't mind if you had a couple drinks. I just have to walk right down there to the rec room, go in and grab a beer from the beer fridge. I could probably have a couple real quick and nobody would even notice. And then I started realizing, wait a second, what's going on here? I should probably call somebody. This is not good that this thought is hanging around as long as it is. Okay, so that was a Saturday night. Monday I meet with a sponsee and I'm explaining the difference between a thought and an obsession. And he says to me, so what'd you do? said, what do you mean? He goes, well, you're sitting here, so you clearly didn't go get a beer from the beer fridge. So what did you do? I said, I don't understand what you're asking me. He goes, did you call somebody? I was like, no. He goes, did you decide not to drink that beer? No. He said, so what happened? And I said, I don't know. I don't know if a boat came roaring through the cove. I don't know if the grill flared up. I don't know if somebody came down the steps. I don't know what happened. But the thought was removed. Something came in and separated that thought from me.
I'm going to read something. It's a book I recently read called The Steps We Took by Joe McQueenie. He was part of the Joe and Charlie duo that revitalized Alcoholics Anonymous with the Big Book. Often the solutions to problems are beyond our imagination. Everything in my life, my work, who I am, everything, has been built on what I thought was the worst thing in my life, my addiction to my alcoholism. When I surrendered to that, my life changed in ways that I could never have imagined. This step, the first step, has to be taken 100%. All the others can be done imperfectly at first, and the program will still work. But the first step has to be taken 100%. It's like damming up water. If you dam it up 99%, the dam will break. But if the water is dammed up 100%, it will be forced to seek another way out. The first step is about surrender. The surrender involved in facing the truth. Father John Doe says that step one is the only non-spiritual step. We have to make it alone. I believe the ability to make it is a grace because there are too many people who die without ever making it. And one of the things I love is as I stay on this path, you know, I can read, agree with a lot of it, disagree with a lot of it, and still get a lot out of it. Right. So the part I really love is about facing the truth of my reality based on evidence. But I'm going to share an experience with you guys because I remember where I was sitting and what I listened to the night I realized that I took a deeper surrender. And I don't like to cuss. I'm trying to really limit the use of profanity when I'm sitting in front of an audience because I do this a good bit. But I'm going to cuss because I don't have any other words available to me in the English language to get my point across. That night I realized how truly fucked I was.
The book says doomed.
Yeah, book says doomed. I like the F word more because you know what I'm talking about. So we're sitting at a Big Book study. This man, Dante, is breaking down the book. And we're reading this paragraph on page 20 says 24, and it says for most alcoholics and addicts. It doesn't say for all. It's the first thing I want to point out. For most alcoholics, you got to find out by examining your own experience and having it confirmed to you whether the paragraph applies to you. It applies to me. For most alcoholics and addicts, for reasons yet obscure, that means for reasons we don't quite understand, they have lost the power to choose whether or not they drink or get high. Their so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. At certain times, we can't bring into our consciousness, our mind, the memory of the suffering and humiliation of a week ago, a month ago, a few days ago. We're reading that paragraph, and I remember, you know, he would sit up at this poker table, and I was the reader at the time. He was sitting to my left. There'd be two other people at the poker table, and there's always anywhere between like 25 and 40 people at this workshop. And he that night, for whatever, and like, he didn't do this other years. You know, later on, I stumbled across another man. His name was Mark Houston. He's passed away. Mark really emphasized these three words too. But Dante, for whatever reason, that night asked us. He goes, "Man, what's the three? What do you guys think are the most important words in this paragraph?" And he goes, it's at certain times. He goes, do any of you know when that's going to happen? And that night, my surrender that this guy's talking about deepened. It was both intellectual and I felt it in my gut. And what I felt was like, I'm fucked. I have no idea when that time's going to come. And all these years and all these well-meaning institutions and all these well-meaning people had always convinced me through the relapse prevention tools that I was going to be able to protect myself from the first drink or drug.
And make the right choice.
And that night, what I said to myself is, I'm going to have to attack this like I attacked smoking crack. There is no middle of the road for a guy like me. I got to go all in. I'm just very blessed and fortunate that the same mentality that I had out on the street followed me into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous. I use it here. And that night deepened my intellectual surrender and a part of my spiritual surrender. But what happened in my courtroom experience with my mother, that was the spiritual surrender. I make a distinction between intellectual surrender and spiritual surrender. Because in an intellectual surrender, you're going to do it with your sponsor. You're going to do it with the guys here that are taking you through this process. You're going to examine your experience. You're going to lay out the evidence. And you're going to ask yourself, do I believe that once I start, I cannot stop? And once I stop, that I can't keep myself from going back. On my own power, I'm always going to go back to the first one. My first step says I will drink again. My first step says that I will get high again. There's no hope in step one. That's intellectual, right? You're looking at it. You're having a discussion. You're weighing out your experience. The spiritual is not something that you decide. The spiritual is something that is lived through you. I lived the spiritual surrender because something died in that moment. And simultaneously, something was born. When you sincerely take such a position, all sorts of remarkable things will happen. Now, that's out of the third step in our big book. But I'll tell you that in that courtroom, I sincerely took a position that night, that day. And it has followed me. Sincerity is a big deal. I was talking to my sponsor today, and we were going back and forth about gauging sincerity and whether or not you're delusional. Can you really? I don't know. There is just a part of me that knows deep down inside, like, when I'm sincere about something. I just believe that. And that's just the next year I might believe something different. But tonight, on a gut level, I think we know when we're sincere and we care. So the way I teach this step when I'm sponsoring guys, it's really easy. Everybody in this room can look at your experience and you are 100% convinced, if you look and find it, that once I start, all bets are off. I don't know what's going to happen. That's really easy to see. There's no choice after we put it in our bodies. Where I've had a very difficult time over the years with guys that I take through this process is them seeing that they don't have any choice before they put it in their bodies. They'll tell me intellectually when we break down the step and we're talking about it that they get it. But then a lot of them, unfortunately, relapse, and they come back from their relapse. Did you choose to relapse? Did you make a choice to relapse? And they're like, yeah, man, I think I wanted to get high. That's the one I heard this week. I think I wanted to get high more than I wanted to stay sober. And I was like, all right, I have failed somewhere along in this process because this is not what we. What does it mean to not have a choice before you put it in your body? I'm going to describe it to you because it does. That doesn't mean we don't have a choice all the time. But this is what, because our society out there tells us we have a choice. All right. Even some treatment centers are all about making the right choices and self-empowerment and all these other things. Right. So I'm going to describe a day in the life of Tarek before recovery. Tuesday night, we go to have the proverbial happy hour drink. And Tuesday night, Tarek drinks far more than he intended to drink. And once Tarek takes the drink and the drink takes Tarek, he starts thinking about crack. Everybody is going home at the bar. It's about 7:30, but I'm just getting started. So I'm going to make a quick phone call. I'm going to head downtown. I buy a slab, $100 worth of crack, go back to my house. I smoke till about, I don't know, 10:30, 11. You know what? Let's go back downtown. Get me another slab. You know, maybe get a hooker. This is my thing. I don't have any like embarrassment of talking, but that was my thing back then. You know, it was part of my experience. I laid that out there because a lot of guys have that experience. You know, and so I want you to be able to come talk to me. But that was my deal. You know, but this particular night, I decided just to go get a slap. I go back to my house and I smoke, and maybe I go back down, maybe I don't. But you know, I'm up. It's like I got to be at the office at 8 o'clock. And by like 4:35, I know I ain't sleeping. So now I'm just chain smoking cigarettes. And I take a bar, a football, a Klonopin, whatever I got. Any Farmies I got, I'm going to take because I need to stop tweaking. All right. So I take a shower. At this time, I'm an analyst, right? I'm a benefit analyst at a company called Century Business Systems. I got a corner office with a nice view. I got a putting green in my office. I mean, I had arrived at this point in my life, right? And I feel like the job is the only real identity I have at this point in the music thing, because the job makes me feel like I've done something with my life. But I'm dying on the inside at this point in my life. And I take the shower, I drive to work, I park the car in the garage. I go up to the reception area, so I'm trying not to make eye contact with anybody because I am tweaking hard, and I fucking dart down the hall to the corner office. I close the door, put do not disturb on the phone. I'm safe now, right? Nobody, doors closed, ain't nobody gonna disturb me. I got do not disturb on the phone. I'm gonna wait until I stop tweaking out, which usually happened around 9:30 or 10 o'clock. All right, so now I open the door to the office. I take do not disturb on the phone. I start working. Around 10:30, I get this image of a 20 rock on the end of my stem and me taking that first blast.
Hey, Derek.
And I go through a choice. I make a choice, right? I go through an intellectual sorting out process. That's what a choice is, right? Examining options. Option A, option B, option C. What are the pros and cons? I'm going to deny this, or I'm going to accept it. Reject or accept. That's how you really make a choice. I spent too much money last night. I got mom's birthday coming up this weekend. I still owe my roommate money from last month's bills. I have access to my willpower. I make a choice. I'm not going downtown tonight. All right, a couple hours go by. It comes back for me, except this time it comes in the form of a text messages from one of the guys down on the block telling me they got something for me, right? And so I'm weighing it out again. I go through the intellectual sorting out process. I have access to my willpower, and I make a choice that I'm not going to get high tonight.
Fuck yeah, look at him all grown up and shit.
Being responsible. This happens to me another time maybe. Well, 5 o'clock rolls around and I've made it, right? I have no thought of getting high at this time. I go to the parking garage, I get in my car, I drive up to this traffic light. If I go straight, I go home. If I go left, I go downtown. The same intellectual sorting out process of weighing out pros and cons and making a choice and having access to my willpower at that certain time at the traffic light was suspended. I just
didn't even call your name.
And there
you
was
just went.
Just went downtown. So weird. Just took a left turn and set the terrible cycle in motion once again. That is what we're up against. See, the obsession, the word obsession, I think, is overused, because I was a victim of the strange mental blank spot and that certain time just as often as I was a victim of like the train, like of like the full on 45, 50 minutes to an hour of all I can think about is like going and I'm not and going and I'm not. That was a strange mental blank spot, you know, and sometimes I would go a couple of days and not have it and then it would happen. And that night when he said that, how do you protect yourself from that certain time at that traffic light? You can't. So at the bottom of page 43 in our big book, once more, Tarek at certain times has no effective defense against the first thought of crack cocaine. Yes. Except in a few rare cases, Tarek nor any other human being can provide such a defense. Yes. Do I believe my defense must come from a higher power in the experience that Brandon described at that barbecue? Because I'll tell you guys, I was in Atlanta a couple months ago. I was going to one of my favorite restaurants called Eats, three blocks over from all the, like, the rooming houses, the boarding houses, the crack houses that I used to hang out at. And I am at my intersection. And I'm talking, there's a couple of working girls out. The guys are out on the corner, and I'm at this traffic light, and I'm telling you, I start thinking about smoking crack. Like, memories, not thinking about doing it in the future, but memories, recollections. And I took a deep breath, and that light turned green, and I went to my restaurant, and I got my food, and I went home. There is a force out there that keeps me safe and protected. I'm not fighting it. I'm not avoiding it. I have been placed in the position of neutrality, safe, and protected. The problem has been removed. That means I don't make a choice today to stay clean and sober. I don't even pray. I can't even tell you the last time I asked God to keep me clean and sober. The thought never occurs to me that I'm not going to be clean and sober, because I'm attempting on a daily basis to live the way of life described in this big book. That is what is available to you. The 10-step promises, people debate me from time to time. They're the strongest, most powerful promises in our big book. For guys like us, who used to be in that hotel room pushing all those stems, my fingers are all black, I've been sweating for days, and I'm looking in that mirror, and that little tear comes out of my eyes, like, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. Can't get out of the hotel. Keep going back. That is possible. You don't have to experience that ever again. That is available here. And I really needed a guy to show me how screwed I was. At certain times, what we do is we convince ourselves that we know what the day looks like that we're going to use again. So as long as I make sure I don't have any day like that and protect myself from those triggers, then I'm going to be okay. I forget that my biggest trigger is inside of me. And I don't know about you, but I usually show up wherever I go. So that's the first step, the first half of the first step.
I often ask guys that I sponsor, what is it going to look like? What is the exact set of circumstances that is going to happen in your life that is going to make you relapse? What is the exact thing that's going to happen? Tell me all the things that are going on that will make that happen. And they look at me and they're like, I don't know that. Okay. Well, if you can't tell me what that is, which one of these steps can you skip? Because I got all sorts of people all the time telling me what steps they can skip and don't have to work on and do all the way. The only way to know that is to know what that relapse day looks like. And if you don't know what that relapse day looks like, the answer is you can't skip any of them. You got to do all of them. That is, if you're a real alcoholic or addict.
Any questions before we wrap up for the evening? All right, guys, we'll see you back here at 9 a.m.